This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Not only is the state mooching off school districts, now the GOP health care bill would cut $500,000 for Bloomington Normal Schools to care for special needs kids.
What happens to them if we can't provide the services? Those services will have to go elsewhere, and someone will have to pay that.
Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel talks about one blow after another. Bloomington police, community groups, and the city council have hammered out a draft ordinance for a new citizen-led police oversight board, and another chance to fly the W.
That and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington police, community groups, and the city council have hammered out a draft ordinance for a new citizen-led police oversight board. The council will discuss the proposal to establish a public safety and community relations board at an open meeting on Monday. The proposed ordinance follows months of negotiations between the city and groups such as Black Lives Matter, Not in Our Town, and the YWCA, who've been dissatisfied with the process for making complaints against Bloomington officers. Tom Cullen of the American Civil Liberties Union of Central Illinois, another of the groups that supports the ordinance, tells GLT's Judy Valente the oversight panel is not a panacea but should help restore trust between some members of the minority community and the police.
The idea here is to increase the avenues for making complaints, but this will not interfere with the police's normal investigation of a complaint.
So a person can go and file their complaint with the Civilian Review Board just as well as going down to the police department and leaving their complaint form.
Right.
The new board, what we're calling the Public Safety and Community Relations Board, has no investigative authority. It can't compel an officer to come and speak to it. It really doesn't have much teeth at all in terms of investigation. How good is that?
Well, we think that this is progress. We understand that we're suffering from the constraints of a collective bargaining agreement that doesn't allow interference with the normal process of the police department in terms of disciplining the officers. And so what this board, this proposed board, would do is review complaints that have been handled by the police department. And then through time, patterns will emerge, recommendations will be made by this board, and they're allowed to publish recommendations and reports. And so this will be something that we feel does have a check and balance for the police department.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more in depth. What will happen if police, for example, find that a complaint is unfounded and the review board disagrees? What happens then?
So you're saying that after a complainant has notified the review board and they've looked at it and there's a discrepancy between what the review board feels about the case, how it was handled, and how the police chief feels?
Exactly. If there's a big discrepancy between the findings of the police department investigation, say they exonerate the officer's actions, and the review board does not.
Well, I think this is where the fact that this would be a public review board, although there would be times that they would have meetings that wouldn't be open, subject to state law, but that this would be where the public's attention would be focused on this. And at that point, that would be for the police department and the chief to explain why they handled the matter the way that they did. And this is the oversight that the community can have on a matter like this.
But they cannot change a police department determination.
We feel that this is a step in the right direction towards police accountability. We give our police officers a monopoly on the use of coercion, and they do that in our name. And so this is something that, particularly in a community where we talk about community policing as often as we do in Bloomington, this is something where the community is going to be able to have a second look. And the primary motive here is both to increase the avenues for complaints and to get feedback on the police, but then also to offer the existing system a little more integrity, where people are sure that it's going to have that second review, a chance for things to see the light of day, and to reassure the public that they can bring these things forward, trust the normal process, and if they're dissatisfied with that, then there will be a second set of eyes there.
The members of the board will be made up of people appointed by the mayor and the council. Can we know that these members will be people who do have the public interest at heart?
Oh, I believe so. I think that when we have people serving on other boards and in city government, when we have people who are elected to the council, we're able to trust that their character has been assessed by those that are doing, whether it's the electorate or it's in this case going to be the mayor with the advice of the council. And so the standards that they put in there is that these will be people with a reputation for fairness, integrity, impartiality, and a sense of public service. And so I think that that can be representatives of a broad and diverse background.
Now, people are going to want to know, is this going to cost anything? Is this going to cost the taxpayers anything? It looks like it's pretty much a wash because they don't have any budget. They don't have any staff. It's a volunteer board.
At this point, I'm not familiar if there have been any cost projections on this, but I agree with your assessment that it would seem like this is going to be a voluntary board and that there probably would be some administrative cost in terms of printing and materials and things like that.
Civilian review boards have not worked smoothly in all cities. The U.S. Justice Department criticized the city of Cleveland's board for a lack of transparency and accountability. In Tampa, Florida, they had political problems with the selection of board members. And in New York City, there were complaints that the review board was co-opted by the police. How can we avoid those pitfalls here?
Well, I think that this will be something that there will be a learning curve for those first members of this board. There's provisions in the proposed ordinance for training and orientation that's going to come from the city legal department and the police department. And then this will be something that as that board continues on and gets some longevity to it, they'll identify needs for their training and also to be able to set up a schedule that works for them to keep interest and to begin to look also at policies overall that they might want to make recommendations in those reports that they're empowered to give based on possibly, complaints that have come forward, but just because of their awareness and their focus on the business of policing in our community.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm talking with Tom Cullen of the ACLU of Central Illinois about a new proposed ordinance for a police community relations board. Tom, there's a provision in this ordinance that would prevent people with a felony criminal record from serving as a member of the police oversight board.
That's the one thing that we're not happy with in this proposal. Overall, we think this is wonderful progress and a great proposal. But the groups in the Alliance of ACLU, Black Lives Matter, NAACP, Not in Our Town, and YWCA, this is something that we've all said we think is fundamentally unfair.
Why would it be unfair?
Well, we're hoping for, people of diverse background. Yes, we want them to have, good character, and we trust our mayor and the council to see to that. But if you think about barring people who've had, any felony conviction and have a record, that could be somebody who that was 30 years ago and now is, a pillar of our community, or that would apply to somebody who that was 1 year ago. And so we think that the standard of, this person being a person of integrity and character is a much better measure that we trust our elected officials to make that determination on a case-by-case basis. We also are hoping to include people who have personal experience with law enforcement. And so to take one particular aspect of our population out of that seems unfair. The other thing is that we have a situation in our criminal justice system in America, nationwide, statewide, and even locally, where there is a disparate impact on people of color, in particular African Americans. So there's been over-policing in general, and there's been the circumstance where that might be unfairly eliminating a larger percentage of those communities of color than we intend to do with this board. The mayor is given some direction on this in Section 3 of the proposed ordinance for the board. It says in subsection D that in making appointments, the mayor shall endeavor to reflect community diversity, including different neighborhoods, income levels, ethnicity, age, gender, sexual orientation, and ability status. So that would seem to make the intent clear that we want everybody to participate in this.
Let's say there's an incident of a police shooting similar to, and no one hopes this would happen here, but similar to what happened in Ferguson, Missouri a few years ago. You have an unarmed citizen shot by the police. It becomes very controversial. There were some shootings like that up in Chicago. The Laquan McDonald shooting comes to mind. What role do you see the review board playing in a controversial police shooting like that should one occur, which of course we hope would never occur here?
The primary role of this board is hopefully creating an environment where the community trusts their police. They feel like their input is heard so that there wouldn't be the possibility of a Ferguson-type environment over, an unfortunate, shooting incident. I believe, I'm not a licensed attorney, but I believe that the state police would investigate a matter like that where there's a shooting. So this board would then be able, to look at that for the community's interest, again, not having the ability to discipline a particular officer or compel testimony. But as I say, I think that this is one of the reasons why this board is necessary, is so that people have trust in their police force and they believe in the integrity of its procedures.
Do you think this is a panacea or just one step on a long path toward improving police-community relations?
I think this is one solid step in the right direction towards police accountability in our community.
Do you think you have the votes on the council to get this ordinance passed?
Yes, we feel we do.
Tom Cullen is a member of the steering committee of the ACLU of Central Illinois. He's been talking about a new proposal for a community police relations review board. Thank you so much, Tom, for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
A discussion of the draft ordinance for a public safety and community relations board will take place at a committee of the whole meeting of the Bloomington City Council Monday at 5 p.m. No action is expected to be taken at that meeting.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, it's a bad season for ticks. The Republican House passed American Health Care Act includes dramatic cuts to Medicaid and substantial cuts to federal funding for schools, Unit 5 and District 87 in Bloomington Normal included. In this Sound Ideas interview, Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel lays out the impact to the Twin Cities.
In between Unit 5 and District 87, you're probably looking over $500,000. So over $500,000. If I just look at Unit 5 in particular, we have nurses who are working in classrooms with medically fragile children. And I want to tell you, without those funds, we don't know where we'd find those dollars. And these are children requiring medical procedures during the school day, such as tube feedings, catheterizations, trachea support, seizure monitoring. Without the nurses, these students would not be in school.
How many kids?
Population would be, we have centers from, you're talking elementary students to junior high students to high school students. So we may have 50 plus students of these particular needs.
And what happens to them if that goes away?
If we can't provide the services, those services will have to go elsewhere. And someone will have to pay that. those dollars, whether it be state, whether it be districts, such as school districts, we are responsible. So, again, this is partial reimbursement. This isn't total reimbursement.
So out of that $500,000 that you get, how much greater is the total cost?
Well, I'd say it's at least 10% above that. So add on another $50,000 at least. Usually we get about 90% coverage. You can imagine this goes into speech therapy and language therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists. I don't believe people realize the things that the services that are actually provided in schools today. Yes, we're all about academics and all about the academic world, but truly, we have to meet many needs of students, from mental health needs to physical needs, as well as their educational needs. And you know, I'm hoping that this part of the bill will be retracted, and they will bring back the Medicare reimbursement.
So, who does pay if the feds don't? Does it devolve on the district as a legal mandate? Does it mean those kids don't go to school and their parents have to not work? What does it mean?
I believe it means it falls on the school's it'll fall to the school and be the school's responsibility. Again, where we find those dollars, I have no idea.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel. We've been updating people about the transportation issues periodically as you come on the show. Tell us what the latest is.
Well, the latest is as we prepare for fall. And yes, I know it's still summer, but we need to have this preparation in line. So we've asked for student, we need data. What was the result of the various changes made, and primarily made in November and December? And I'll tell you that the on-time percentage went from roughly a low of 88% low of on-time to May was roughly 99.9%. So a tremendous shift. And I will say that was because of a couple reasons. One would be the rerouting of buses and their master router coming and assisting in that process. Second of all, the number of drivers available. So drivers available during that time, at that November board meeting, we said, we are demanding that we have at least 15 to 20% of drivers available to sub in. And we went from a low of 3 drivers in September to in May, we were averaging 18 drivers. And that's significant when we talk about those kinds of numbers. Again, when you have 123 routes or buses that are driving on the road, 10% would be 12, 20% would be 24. So we're hovering right around that 16 to 17% range, which is exactly where we wanted. Thus, we had drivers, we had correct routing, and I would say we have a manager at First Student now locally that is exceptional. And there's a new culture at First Student. One is it's about customer service. It's about – that's a tough touch. You know, parents are sometimes very frustrated and where's my child, and trying to deal with that emotion can be very difficult. I can understand police officers and people who have to take those kinds of calls and how to de-escalate things. But again, First Student's working on that, even that piece of communication. So we've been, again, looking at running similar routes because we feel as if we have the routing has been very, very good. It actually separated the junior high and the high school students, which I think, except for a few buses, which I think was a good call. Second of all, we're also seeing they're already working on our specialized routes. Those would be the early childhood routes, and we've talked about those routes where we may only have 4 students we pick up in a certain region, but it takes 50 minutes to pick up 4 students. So we're utilizing more and more vans, and they're helping route those vans. So I see a stronger collaboration between Unit 5 and First Student. And our expectation is we don't start where we started August 2016. We start where we left May of 2017.
Parents will be happy to hear that.
We're never feeling totally confident because we've been through that storm. But we're doing all we can to get there. And I'll also say this. There are always hiccups the first week of school because of this is new for students.
You have some new drivers.
Some new drivers, although they are having 4 days of driver mock runs, doing it individually, but then actually on the bus 2 days. So I'm feeling more confident, but again, am I at 100% level of confidence? I don't think that'll ever exist in my world.
Unit 5 had a significant presence at the most recent Bloomington Council meeting and succeeded in getting another look and an impact study on a proposed low-income housing development that Unit 5 had said would potentially adversely affect the Cedar Ridge Elementary. Mayor Renner has expressed some doubt that it would really be that big an impact because it really includes only 10 units that would likely be having tenants that could have children. Is that a persuasive argument on his part?
I would say this. If they could place that in writing, I'd be much more assured. The situation is we're already in a high volume of low income in that particular elementary school and where these residents would be residing. And therefore, that would increase even more. Now, there are a total of 54 units there, 10 designated for low income, 10 designated for people with disabilities, and 34 at market value. My question also would be, where these are going to be placed, what will be the market value? And I understand they're 1, 2, and 3 bedroom apartments. And if they can't attain the market value that they state, what will they do with those particular apartments? If they could provide us with assurance, I don't think there's any issue here. But I do want to say that I think it's good business to come together, both the city and the school district, and to have this discussion and to look at if there is, and again, we asked for an impact study. And I think that's good business. I think that's good business for the city and it's good business for the schools that then serve the kids of the city.
And that's something that has historically not always happened. Witness the placement of Normal Community High School. That was a surprise to the town when it was initially rolled out. Why the shift? Is it because the matters are so fiscally more urgent now, or is it just a matter of who's sitting in the top chairs?
Well, it's always somewhat leadership, I think. But I also will say this. We have never been in the fiscal times we are today. So all nonprofit organizations are coming together and trying to figure out how to continue to provide the services we're providing. My business is about schools and about education. But at the same time, how can we work together? How can we bring those entities together and truly come to a solution that is going to be best for our community and our citizens here in Bloomington Normal? So, you know, maybe the impact study will show that they're right on, and maybe we could get some assurances. And yes, I know our teachers are going to do their level best to educate each child. But again, it does create some additional strain on resources. We know that. And that building in particular does amazing things. And I'm very proud, and I'll tell you, if my kids would go to that school, I would be very, very pleased to this day. because I've seen the quality of instruction by our teachers and the principal leadership. So we just want to maintain that, and we want to have assurances that perhaps if we do have to put additional dollars in there, maybe there's something as well that the city can help us with.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Mark Daniel is our guest, the superintendent of Unit 5 Schools. The district just recently approved a $170,000 contract for virtual classrooms.
Right.
That will allow some educational sharing of Normal Community and Normal West High Schools. What classes do you think are those likely to be used for?
Well, when we started floating this idea, we had a few teachers come to the surface right away and thinking, whoa, how could I share? In other words, it might be an AP Advanced Biology course. This is such new territory, but we do think this is going to be a trend, and we want to be part of the we want to be part of that innovation. For instance, if we are if we do have an AP course here in our own building, could that teacher also share some of her expertise with other districts? We're not even close to doing that yet, but that could be a potentially a use of it. But I will say this. I do have teachers who are teaching, say, internship courses where their students will come in on a Friday morning and they'll share their experiences. We just doubled that exposure because now both buildings are able to share that. And the equipment, I've seen it. Muhammad Seymour already has it installed. I've been to several places where ZDI has had their equipment installed, and they also provide this type of classroom experience with DeFry University. So again, a virtual learning platform. We did a workshop, and the superintendent at Muhammad Seymour and I, and really to expose ourselves to this type of learning, and be quite frank, we had people that were piped in. Their last comment was, it was as if we were actually there. Well, they weren't there. They're 20, 30, 40, 60, some 120 miles away. And yet that experience was very real. And I think it was something that we could, we took that and said, wow, how can we share this opportunity with it with our teachers? So this is very much a pilot. We don't have any hard set plans. This is the first year to become acclimated to this type of learning.
Are there evolved do's and don't best practices already in other places that have had them for longer?
I will tell you that there are. Certainly the university level. We've had online learning as well, but never to this degree, because I truly believe you still need the human element. It's one thing to go online and work through a course that's driven strictly by type. But when you have conversation, when you have interaction, when you have questioning, there's the difference. And I think that's where you need the human element. We're trying to figure out what are the applications. No longer do we need to have, because this is also part of the Cisco format, so we can now have administrative, we call it administrative council. We have all of our administrators, principals come together once a month. Well, now they can stay within their buildings. We're going to attempt to do that too. By the way, that saves us some money, because usually we have to have, certainly at the elementary buildings, we have to have a person who's covering that principal. That will no longer be necessary if the principal's there and still in the building. The board started thinking of various ideas even last night as well, and they became very excited, which was very pleasing for me to see the enthusiasm and so forth. So I'm thinking that by the time we're finished with this, certainly by spring of next year, we'll have some very real ideas on how we're going to move forward. Again, this isn't just driven by district office administration. We want our UFIA leadership involved as well, and because there are some ramifications in regards to teachers, and we need to work through that. But I've just mentioned some things like perhaps professional development. One particular board member said, boy, you know, start measuring the usage of the buildings and see what kind of conflict and scheduling there was. Perhaps we need to have even additional classrooms like this. But again, innovative uses, talk to students, talk to teachers, having a demo day for the public to see, maybe on curriculum night or something like that. But I'm excited when I hear teachers talk about how they're going to share their teaching, share the learning, and no longer is it confined to just four walls and a building.
Mark Daniel is the superintendent of Unit 5 schools.
Your garden after winter, some plants are barely alive.
We can rebuild it. We have the technology. We have the know-how to make your garden grow. We can make it better than before. Better, greener, growier.
Bring new life to your garden with advice from Murph on Grow. Today at 850 and 450 on GLT. Send your gardening questions to WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Soderstrom Skin Institute. Founded in 1973, their team of board-certified dermatologists treat acne, psoriasis, skin cancer, and all diseases of the skin. Soderstrom Skin Institute has immediate openings for appointments at 2100 Jacobson Drive in Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a chance to celebrate the Cubs' first world championship in more than 100 years. After a relatively mild winter, the warning has gone out. Watch out for ticks. The Center for Disease Control predicts this summer will be one of the worst in years for ticks. That means trouble for you and for your pets. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
Fleas get all the attention, but ticks can be more vexing for your pet since they can inflict a number of diseases on both humans and animals. Dr. Matt Fraker of Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal says one in particular, Lyme's disease, has helped bring tick-borne diseases to the public's attention. Fraker says there are four main species of ticks in central Illinois, all of them capable of carrying a multitude of diseases.
So you're looking at Lyme's disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, there's several Ehrlichial diseases, babesiosis, tularemia. You've got a real nasty stew of stuff that these guys carry. And humans can get it, dogs can get it, cats can get it.
Fraker says there's much less tick-borne disease in cats due to their grooming habits. Dogs are far more likely to have tick problems. And not just dogs in rural areas either. City dogs are also at risk.
If you live in some new subdivision in Bloomington Normal, then you mow your lawn every day and you don't think your dog get a tick, you're wrong. That dog's less likely to get tick access, but it can get tick access.
So if you go hiking with your dog, or camping, or even to the dog park, ticks are a threat to your canine. And not just in the summer.
We have ticks year-round now. Even if we have a heck of a bad winter, I have had an exoded tick. That's the little black-legged deer tick, one that carries Lyme's disease. And my wife had to get one out of me after I'd been out in 10-degree weather in a snow-filled January. So they're out all year round. When you look at all the species we have, there are some time of year that some portion of each species, some life cycle of every species is active.
Conventional wisdom says that you should check your dog for ticks each time your pooch comes in from outside. Or should you?
It's about half sensible and half senseless because the adult ticks aren't the only ones that carry disease, and they're the ones you're probably going to be able to find on a pet. If you go through your pet carefully, you might find the adult ticks on them, and that's part of the threat. But the larval stages are the size of a period in a sentence, and I think a human would have trouble finding them on themselves. You know, their hairless arms or legs or bodies. Then you go to your shaggy pet who's been around the field, and the chances of finding any of the younger life stages are really very, very unlikely.
The longer a tick feeds on your pet, the greater the chance for disease. To remove a tick on your dog, don a pair of surgical-style gloves. You can use a commercially prepared tick remover gadget or just utilize a pair of tweezers. Grasp the tick as close to your pet's skin as possible and gently pull outward in a steady, straight motion. Make sure you get all of the tick. Clean your dog's skin with antiseptic and give that good dog a treat. You'll want to get that tick out because the longer a tick feeds on your pet, the greater the chance for disease.
So if you have a tick attached to you, that just attached to you, or your dog. It's not engorged. It's not filled with blood. This is gross, but, you know, the engorged ticks almost look like a corn nut stuck to your dog. Those ticks have fed long enough to transmit disease. But if you pull a tick that just attached off, that tick probably hasn't transmitted disease. You might get inflammation at the attachment site, but in terms of, did you just contract Lyme's disease or Ehrlichiosis? No, that's probably going to, that's a higher risk for a tick that's fed over a period of time.
Fraker says there are signs your dog is hosting a tick.
The classic presentation for a tick-borne dog is a dog that just feels like garbage and may or may not have lameness. That seems to be the most common thing we see, because some of these tick-borne diseases share their preferences to make the joint sore and to do bad things to the bloodstream. And in the process, these animals will usually mount an immune response that is sort of like a flu-like syndrome. They'll get fevers. They'll just get crappy. I mean, they just look bad. And then they hurt. And sometimes that hurt's real obvious. Sometimes they've got a clear lameness. Sometimes they're lame in one leg, and then we call it shifting lameness. They'll get lame in the other. And a lot of times that inflammation is at the very last joint, the wrist joint, the last joint before the paw or the ankle joint where the heel of the dog is. Those areas will get a little bit swollen, and if you put any pressure on those areas, you'll get a response, a pretty significant response from the animal.
Fraker recommends when you take your dog in for heartworm screening, get your pet tested for tick-borne diseases at the same time.
And that just tells us if they've been exposed. It doesn't mean they're actively infected.
There are weapons out there for minimizing tick burdens on dogs. A tick control product can protect your pooch.
I frankly think every dog should be on them. And all of these products are flea products also. We have very few products that are tick-only products. The most popular ones are also, they're blowing away fleas while they're protecting against ticks. So it's like, if you don't think you have a tick issue, well, then protect your pet for fleas and just make your veterinarian relax, knowing that there's some tick protection on board also.
As scary looking as ticks are, and by the way, they're arachnids, not insects. Their bite is not necessarily a death sentence for your dog.
Lyme's disease is typically, like in humans, it's typically an arthropathy. It's typically an arthritis-based disease. The other diseases can wipe out portions of the bloodstream or cause radical changes in the bloodstream. I mean, they can be very life-threatening, but most of them are also very responsive to doxycycline. There is a form of Lyme's disease where it can get into the kidneys. Labs and golden retrievers, I think, seem genetically predisposed to this form of Lyme's disease. That one has had significant mortality.
Even with all we do know about the diseases ticks carry, there's still more that we don't know. Veterinarian Matt Fraker says your best defense is to use tick protection products and never, ever underestimate a tick's ability to get under the skin, no matter when, no matter where. I'm Laura Kennedy.
If you have a pet-related question for one of the Animal House team of experts, email us at wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Chicago Cubs fans relished the team's first World Series championship in more than a century last year. Books about the season and the series are starting to come out. Gary Cohen is the author of an early entry in that market. GLT correspondent Brian Bloodworth talks with Cohen, who's also the editor of the Cubs official magazine, Vineline. The book is Fly the W.
The 2016 Cubs were such a fun team to cover, such an easy team to cover. They got along well. They played hard. And you know, they jumped out to a fast start and kind of never looked back. But even if you go back to the postseason, you can you know, recount instances where they overcame adversity, and it just gave us a ton of material to work with.
Did you start the season thinking like with that in the back of your mind?
Deep in the back of my mind, you know, when it's been so long and you follow the Cubs and you cover the Cubs, there's always that little part of you that goes, well, it's been so long, it seems like a long shot. As the season went on and it started seeming more realistic, we got serious about it. And because I'm actually also the editor-in-chief of the Cubs magazine, Vineline, so myself and my team and the Cubs, we're gathering content all year long. We're covering the team. And so we kept all of that and sort of kept an eye on what happens if they do go all the way this year. And then as it got really close to the end of the year, you know, a couple of people on the Cubs front office staff, Colin Faulkner, Allison Miller, and myself started talking about the possibility of making this book. But obviously the the trick and the complication with all this is it was all contingent on them winning the World Series. So we could have been gathering material and writing sections and you know, putting a ton of work in. And then if things had gone differently after that rain delay in Game 7, there would have been no book. So, you know, it was always a risky proposition, but one that we were happy to embark on.
It just looked like a fun team to be around.
It really was. It you know, I think every good team has that story of, well, the clubhouse gets along so great and they're all good players. I do think, having covered this team for many years, that this was kind of a special clubhouse. The team did just get along so well. They were fun to cover. They were good personalities. They had that never-say-die attitude. And I think a lot of that comes down to the kind of players that Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer and Jason Cloud and the Cubs powers that be are recruiting into the system, which are drafting and trading for, which are generally decent human beings, low-maintenance human beings, guys who are more concerned with the team than they are with their individual stats. And then obviously you've got Joe Maddon at the helm, and Joe Maddon set such a great tone for the team and, you know, let these guys be creative and have their individual personalities and make sure that they have fun out there. And so that set a good tone for the team as well.
Joe was a perfect fit for that team, wasn't he?
I think he was, yeah. When the Cubs let Rick Renteria go a few years ago and brought Joe Maddon on, and that was a really tough decision, but you don't get many opportunities to add a seasoned veteran guy like Joe Maddon into your organization. And obviously, during his time with Tampa Bay, Joe Maddon had shown that he was really good at nurturing and getting the best out of these young teams and young players. And because of his own player development background and attitude, he just was such a perfect fit for this team and continues to be. And not only for the team in the clubhouse, but a great deal of what a manager does is deal with the media and you know, take the slings and arrows. And he's so good at that part of it, too. And the guy always has something interesting to say. So there was a point during the book where we kept thinking, are we using too much Joe Maddon in this? But everything he says tends to be really interesting and really well thought out. So I do think he was really an ideal fit for this organization and for the particular team that they had.
The team, anything surprise you about it during the season?
You know, they started off so well. And I think in baseball, that your wins can come at any time. But when they come at the beginning of the season, that can really set a tone for the team and, you know, give the team confidence. And they had a lot of comeback wins early, which gave them that kind of confidence that they could continue to do that. But then they hit that that little spell that they had before the All-Star break, where they just were out of gas and they weren't playing well. And basically, they had a month and a half of baseball where they just didn't look like themselves. Now, they built such a good lead that it didn't end up hurting them that much. But the way they rebounded from that in emphatic fashion, I think that was the thing that really set the tone for this team, is they're not going to stay down, that they can handle adversity. And of course, you know, when you play in Chicago for the Cubs, as soon as you have that downturn, the fan base has this tendency to start panicking and thinking that the wheels are going to fall off. And they showed that they were really a resilient team. And I don't know if that surprised me, but it was certainly nice to see. And then that carried through the postseason. I mean, they were in a bad situation in the division series with the Giants. They were in a bad situation going into Los Angeles for three games, down in the series in the NLCS. And obviously they were in an almost historically bad situation in the World Series, going back to Cleveland, you know, going down 3-1 and then going back to Cleveland, having to win both games on the road. And that resilience really carried them through the whole year.
What about the players? A lot of different personalities there, but who were the kind of the guys that were the leaders or the guys that people gravitated to on that team?
Well, there's one guy who has certainly gotten a lot of press lately, but it was hard to avoid, was David Ross. Ross was such a great leader for that team. And I think there were two kinds of leaders on that team. Number one was the David Ross kind of leader who was very vocal all year. He's a veteran guy. I mean, I'm sure people have now seen him on Dancing with the Stars and on ESPN. Great personality, very vocal, had a great sense of when to step in, when to mentor the young players, when to back off. But he's also just kind of a magnetic personality. People gravitate toward him. He's really talkative. He's really friendly to everybody. And I think he had that veteran gravitas that people listened to him. Another type of leader on that team, too, which was a quieter leader who kind of led by example. And those were guys like John Lester, John Lackey, Jason Hayward. Those guys aren't the most vocal guys in the clubhouse. They're not the rah-rah guys who are going to, you know, walk into the clubhouse and talk to every guy. But they are veterans. They've been in the trenches. They've been in the postseason. Guys like Lester and Lackey have won championships. And they know when to step in and say something. And when those guys talk, the younger guys in the clubhouse listen. And there's been a lot of talk this year about Jason Hayward stepping up and being that guy for everybody. He doesn't, you know, he's not, I wouldn't say he's quiet, but he's not always the guy who's front and center. But when things are going bad, he is a guy who will step up. And when he talks, the players tend to listen. You know, obviously he was a guy in Game 7 in the World Series last year when they went into that rain delay and were shell-shocked by the Rajai Davis home run. He was the guy who called that now famous historic meeting in the weight room and brought the guys in and reminded them of what kind of team they were and how good they were, and if they just kept playing their game, that they were going to win. And that's the kind of leader that Jason Hayward is. When he talks, people listen, and he tends to pick the right times.
What do the fans not know or did not know about this team?
Right, and that's one of the things that I think makes this book so special. Because we are the official book of the Cubs, we were able to get some stuff that nobody else can get. And part of that is because we had Stephen Green, who's the team photographer and has been with the team since, I believe, 1983. So he's got access to things that people just don't have access to. So it is a hardcover coffee table book, so there's a lot of copy. We take it through the whole season, going from really the beginning of the Theo Epstein-Tom Ricketts collaboration in 2011 all the way to the World Series and to the White House visit. But we also have a ton of photos, and Stephen Green was able to go in and get things that nobody else can get. For instance, you know, you've probably heard by this point about the Cubs celebration room, where they go after wins and spray water on each other and dance and have a good time. Well, Steve's in the celebration room with these guys, so you can see what it looks like. One of the other things that we have that I think offers some pretty unique insight is we have personal letters from some of the Cubs' all-time great players and front office executives. So we have personal letters that were written by Tom Ricketts, Theo Epstein, Joe Maddon, Crane Kenny, the president of business operations, Billy Williams, Hall of Famer, Ryan Sandberg, Pat Hughes, the radio broadcaster. They talk about what the World Series meant to them. You know, Sandberg and Williams both spoke in their letters about how important this World Series win was to them and how they feel like, as members of the Cubs organization, a weight has been lifted from them, too. Like, they finally won a World Series.
What about the players themselves? Superstitions, idiosyncrasies, anything like that?
Most players aren't too eager to share their personal superstitions, but they all kind of have it. But Joe Maddon was very, very close to his father, who, you know, was a plumber in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and apparently just a very stand-up guy in the city. And he had passed away several years ago, back around the time that Maddon was still with the Angels, and the Angels won the World Series in 2002. And so Maddon said he's not a guy who keeps a lot of memorabilia and trinkets from his time, but his father was. And so his father had this old Angels hat, the one with the wings from, you know, that they used in the movie Angels in the Outfield, that old Angels uniform. And Maddon had that whole season with the Angels, had kept that hat in his locker and would sort of, like, at key moments, go back in and touch the hat just as kind of a gesture to communicate with his father, and it's a bit of a superstition. And then during the final game of that series, he put the hat, you know, put the bill of the hat in the back of his pants and had it with him, so he kind of felt like his father was with him. He did that same thing this year. So as the season went on, he had his dad's hat with him. And he said during that rain delay, he went and got the hat and did the same thing, put the hat in the back of his pants so he had his father there with him as he won those two World Series. So, and that's something that Maddon actually said in his letter is right now his father is 2-0 in Game 7 of the World Series. So it's a pretty lucky hat.
We're located in Central Illinois, obviously, and Ben Zobrist was obviously caught the attention of a lot of people, but he is just a true blue-collared, hard-nosed, great guy, isn't he?
He really is, and he was such a great addition to this Cubs team because it is a young team, and getting a guy like Ben Zobrist, like you said, he's first off, he's just such a nice guy, and he is a hard worker, and the way that he came into his career, you know, he was a guy, when he came up with Tampa Bay, he didn't have a position. I mean, he was a shortstop, but Tampa Bay had a shortstop, and so he was kind of the precursor to this modern super utility man that now every team seems to have, and the Cubs have plenty of. And that's because of his relationship with Joe Maddon, that he was a guy that Maddon wanted to get on the field, and Zobrist was willing to do whatever the team asked of him to get on the field. And so, he just has such a good attitude, and he's such a good presence in the clubhouse. And especially because coming into the Cubs last year, he had just come off of a World Series win with Kansas City, so he brought that with him. Like I said, I just think he's been a fantastic addition to this clubhouse and to Chicago, and it's such a nice thing. I mean, he kind of grew up in Cardinals territory, which is probably a little bit closer to where you guys are located. But to feel like he was coming home to Illinois, and, you know, he went to Olivet Nazarene, it's not too far from here, and now is a partner of the Cubs. And so it felt like a lot was coming together for him where, you know, he was kind of bringing his family and his life back home, and then, you know, helping the state where he grew up, helping the Chicago Cubs win a World Series. It was such a big moment for him and for his family.
Gary Cohen is the author of Fly the W About the Cubs World Series Season. He spoke with GLT correspondent Brian Bloodworth. The 300-page glossy coffee table book is available online. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Find the complete show, podcast, and all of the individual interviews, thanks to Brian Bloodworth, thanks to Laura Kennedy, thanks to Judy Valente, at our website. Again, that's WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Share your thoughts at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. This is GLT on WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.